And then you're off looking into space.
It's not on yet.
It is on.
It's not on.
You're on!
Cameras aren't even running. Hi and welcome back. This is Microsoft Virtual Academy Jumpstart for C Sharp. We are going into Module 5. You have just eaten lunch. You're feeling good. You're ready to learn. We're ready to teach.
Let's hit it.
Let's hit it.
So what we're going to cover today, or in this module, I should say. So we're going to look at type and value validation.
Ah, yes. Validation.
Validation is a key problem that we have to solve. It's unfortunate we can't trust our users to put in the correct stuff, but it's one of sad life.
We cannot even trust other developers to give us good value.
And I don't trust you.
I'm not sure who I trust.
Indeed. That's it. Good job the compiler's there.
The only person I really trust is the compiler.
Exactly. So that's type and value validation. Clearly we had too much sugar at lunch. And then we're going to move on to encryption techniques, which is obviously a bit of a deeper topic.
But awesome.
But very awesome.
Yes.
Okay. Without further ado.
Let's begin validation.
Let's do it. Type and value validation.
Validation is really a mindset, Darren. It's you really do. We were joking earlier about who do you trust. But as a developer, you have to not trust anything that's coming into your system. So how do you get data into your system? Well, there's a lot of ways. A service can give you data. You can read from a file that you're going to be parsing. You could be exposing an API that somebody is passing values into. Like you alluded to, a user can be typing information in data entry forms.
You can put
forms.
Your whiskey down there.
Yeah. There's no camera. There's no camera. Nobody knows what you're talking about. There's a camera right now.
There is a human being on the end of this camera. And
I'd like
have
to
a
do a quick
humor.
Call out to Barry, our camera switcher. That's the way he says hi.
Exactly.
Where were we going? Where were we?
We were talking about validation and the fact that there are many sources of data.
There really are a lot of ways for you to get data, and the moment you trust any of them is the moment you introduce instability into your application.
Yeah.
You want to be good-natured, you want to be trusting, but you can't write an app that way. Like we talked about it earlier in the morning, you want to be defensive. You want to write assuming that your application could really suffer from bad data, suffer from what the user passes in, you want to be able to write your application so it's robust, that it handles those and doesn't get broken because of something that's broken outside of it. So that's where data validation comes
in. It's only paranoia if the users aren't out to get you.
Right. I always say users are the worst part of software development.
Exactly. Software is perfect until it gets used.
Or tested. Testers are just as bad.
We actually love them all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is fundamentally what data validation is.
Well, let me back up again and keep going, because I think the problem with it is it's not just that the data's bad. It's that it could be okay, but it's out of range, right? You expect the number to be between something and something, and they've given you one too many. Or they are typing in like we talk about with regular expressions, an email address. They give you a valid string, but not a valid email address.
Exactly. You know, it's more about we place constraints on our expectations. You know, in order to develop an application, we're building a finite state machine. It's not an infinite state machine. So we have to constrain the scenarios that we're dealing with. Otherwise, we would never complete the activity that we're trying to code.
Yeah.
And so in order to allow our system to operate down those constrained guidelines, we need to put limits, as you say, range checks and those kind of things. So that's a lot of what we're talking about right now.
And sometimes it's more than just stability we're trying to protect. Sometimes it's security. And mm-hmm. The reality is there are ways to overflow an application and take advantage of it, to do SQL injection and mm-hmm. things like this that can really be detrimental. So this pays off not only in stability or maybe performance, but also in security as well.
Yeah. I mean, we throw in that term SQL injection. And so basically, to those people who aren't familiar with what SQL injection is, there was a class of sort of naive applications that allowed you to type into a text box, say in a web application, and submit that, and that information was sent directly to a SQL database, and the SQL database executed that as if it was a command, and so you could do malicious activities such as deleting tables, deleting records, and so on and so forth. And so a whole class.
This sounds like an edge case, but it was common for a long time.
It was very common. It was a common attack vector, and so Yeah. You have to program defensively. We talked about this a little bit beforehand.
Yeah. Validation's the way to do it, too.
Exactly.
All right, so let's talk about some of the techniques for validation. I love this. I love talking about this. I believe there are true best practices that we can give to developers that they can use. So the first one would be to trust the compiler. So the compiler does a lot of work for you. Mm-hmm. They make sure that we talked about type safety, make sure the type is right. The compiler cannot do the value validation. That's really going to be up to you. And so we have a couple nice ways to work through validation. One of them is debugging just the application itself and tracing. And what we can do, a lot like unit tests, where you can have asserts inside a unit test, you can do debug and trace asserts that evaluate to a Boolean condition like an if statement would. And that assertion can be something like number not less than 3. That would be a type of assertion that would return true or false. We can put that inside a debug, or we can put that inside a trace assert, and if it fails, it will literally stop at that point and notify the user. Now, there's a difference between debug and trace, Darren. Mm-hmm. Debug happens during a debug session while I happen to be attached to a debugger, so I can step through it.
Yep.
Very big deal is trace. Trace, of course, happens all the time.
So we can trace in a release build as well as a debug build.
Common mistake, a big problem when your application is showing debug information in release.
Yes.
I would say that is a non-optimal behavior.
Suboptimal for sure.
Suboptimal, yeah. I don't want to say non-optimal.
Well, that would be dumb, yeah.
Thank you. Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Gosh, I was right about you. So, another thing you could do, this is a way of not just validating, but reacting to an invalid state would be through raising an exception. Especially when we're talking about things passed to an application. So the arguments that are being passed to a method, arguments could be null, so you could raise an argument null exception. It could be out of range, you could pass an argument out of range exception. You could also just pass a general argument exception. This is a good way, a typed exception like this is a good way to say this isn't just an error, this is a type of error, and that type of error is whatever that type is. So here an argument exception speaks directly to say what is going wrong. And then you can add to the that exception to say more detail, add a message to it, and things like that as well. So it points to a specific one. If we were to look at this, so we have a sample on a method for set name. And so set name is easy enough, a small little method that all it does is set the value. And if you really look at it, all it is the very last line, this.name equals value. And all this other is just extra. It's almost like commenting. It just feels like stuff you don't need, but it's stuff you absolutely must need.
I mean, a point I'd like to make here is that often when people are looking at sort of sample code and they may be out at MSDN and so on and so forth, people often comment, well, it's not real code in that I don't have to, there isn't all of this defensive programming in there to ensure that these things are safe. What people have to understand is that those are examples are out there to demonstrate how to use a particular feature,
right,
not to repeatedly show you how to do defensive coding. In this demonstration, we're really focusing on showing you some of those concepts that you need to leverage whenever you're actually building true production applications.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's funny how it goes both ways too, right? Mm-hmm. You make a simple demo too simple, and it's not real world. You make it too complicated, and it's not simple enough. It was hard to win, but the reality is demos are demos, and they're really meant to demonstrate something. This is a beautiful demo that represents the full scaffolding around protecting your data. Now, it may even do more than what we really want, but let's take a look. So the first action that it does is it looks to validate whether or not it's empty. And empty is great because string has a method that gives us a way to check it. This would be the same thing as saying that it's not null and it doesn't equal empty string. Mm-hmm. But wraps it all into a nice little helper function for us. And then naturally I would raise an argument null exception, right? There's really nothing else you could raise. There's no argument empty exception. And then it's nice because we're able then to pass value to indicate the exact argument that had a problem. If I had multiple arguments in this method, I could indicate them all, and I would have some sort of test for all of them. All right, so the second one is validating a conflict. So in this case, you know, if let's say that the value they're passing in for name is already name. And so I'm going to raise an argument, or I'm going to raise an exception because they can't be the same. You can't set it to itself. Now, what's important is if you're going to create a scenario where an exception is going to be raised, it is imperative that you also create a scenario where the developer can avoid that exception. So if you're going to raise an exception that says, you know, value equals name, and you can't set it to itself, you should only raise that exception if the developer outside of your API is able to check that first, right? You don't want to let exceptions be the way that you message between applications.
Yeah. We've mentioned exceptions a lot, but we really haven't gone into much detail around them. But the name actually is the clue. To raise an exception should be the exception, not the norm. Something exceptional has occurred that hasn't really been planned for, can't really be dealt with within the context of the set name environment. It needs to be dealt with external to that. Therefore, we're raising this as an error condition. Mm-hmm. If it's something that could be anticipated, if, say, for example, we could deal with a duplicate name just by not setting the value and just returning back as if it was successful, then we should do that. We should only raise exceptions in the scenario where we cannot cater for the scenario that we've encountered.
Yeah, so we were talking about earlier using is, and is a neat way to check to make sure the value is right, the type is right. That's going to be an important check as well, especially if you have some sort of derivable type that you don't know for sure what's going to be passed in. So look at this slide. So this slide gives us three more options. So let's go to, I'll just let you handle it for now on. Go back one.
No, thanks very much for that.
All right, so check it out. So the first one is if the cat is a dog, right, which we know isn't true, so we say it's a not supported exception. Choosing the exception type is going to kind of be up to the developer. You could create custom exceptions that are way more explicit. You could say cat is not dog exception if you really wanted to. That's because there is a base exception. And really the only caveat around that is to make sure you make it serializable so that it doesn't ruin any of the services you might use it in. if cat is dog, that allows me to see if it's the type. But it's neat because we also see in the second one, if cat double equals dog. And so not equals the dog doesn't mean that they're not the same type, doesn't mean it's not a specific type. It means it's not the exact same object in memory. And so this is important because it could potentially be true. Cat could equal dog if we had two variables and they equaled each other, mm-hmm. right? So that it doesn't imply necessarily that it couldn't be true. And the last one is using the dot equals, and we talked about this just slightly, kind of leading into it in the morning. And equals is different because equals it can be implemented different ways, and you can do a custom implementation of equals so that it goes in and checks specific properties, but doesn't check, say, like a key or something like that. Mm-hmm. Either way around it, it's not looking to see if they're the same object. It's looking to see if they have the same values. On a simple value, like integer, it just checks number to number. Mm-hmm. But on a complex object that you might create, you might override equals so that it checks exactly what it needs to make sure
they're
equal.
For example, you could use name. You know, if the name is the same, then these are equal.
It could be that simple of logic.
Yeah.
That's really right. Okay, perfect. The data validation process is imperative. It's very important that we do it. It's imperative that we do it. But there are other ways to do it as well. Mm-hmm. And data contract. I absolutely, absolutely, positively love data contracts. And so data contracts, they have been around for quite some time in the .NET framework, implemented sometimes in a CTP, implemented sometimes in a... also with an add-on to Visual Studio. And here's the way it works. Design by contract is the concept,
Frank,
that's basically saying I can predefine how you interact with methods. I can predefine how you interact with properties based on just the same way that an interface is a contract for a class. I can create a contract for all of these other mechanisms that also become a way of data validation. And so data contracts are powerful for two reasons. One, it is a consistent way of doing it. If you're checking for this and raising whatever exception, I don't know what's going to happen. If you, that's typical validation and it doesn't go away. You can't get away from that in a lot of situations. Contracts are different because it's a uniform way of approaching it, but it's also cool because I get to check what's coming in, just like you would expect to be able to check the arguments of a method or the argument of a setter for a property, but I also get to do the output as well and validate the operation of the method is what I would expect it to be. That's a big difference. Contracts enable this, where I can have preconditions, whatever's coming in, and I can have postconditions of whatever's going out, and making sure I'm really defining my class and my methods that much more. And
how does that work or help us in comparison to, say, using exceptions and your debug traces? You know, what's different about using contracts?
Well, there's a lot of similarity. So one of them is, well, first of all, being able to check for the output is very difficult, right? So that second part would be a huge amount of scaffolding for you to put together anyway. However, much like traces, I can create. So if I have a trace, I could create a trace listener. And so that allows me to receive the trace messages and put them somewhere in a file or wherever it is that I want them to be. I can create a type of trace listener, a listener for code contract violations as well, and put those somewhere as well. So in that sense, they're nearly the same, right? I still can get an exception raised, a contract exception whenever it's not valid. But what I can't do with regular validation is at code time, at compile time, in the static environment of development, I can't check to see whether or not they're being violated. Contracts are special. So contracts do run at runtime, like you would expect, but they also run at, design time. When I'm developing my application inside the static environment, behind the scenes, it's an add-on to Visual Studio that makes sure that whatever it is I'm passing in, whatever it is I'm using, whatever it is I've set up as a contract for this method or property is true even now. So I were inside inside some code, I set up a contract, cannot be null, I'm passing null to it, I would get an error right here in Visual Studio. It wouldn't even have to run the application.
So it's basically using the compiler's understanding of what you've written to explore your code and evaluate all the code paths to ensure that that contract would be satisfied.
That's right. And it's those. It's because they're discrete and defined predicates that define what an individual contract. So I can have many, many assertions
so
in
what's
a contract.
A predicate?
So a predicate, well, that's an excellent point. So a predicate is a what's the short word for a predicate? Predicate is pred.
A predicate is fundamentally something that evaluates to true. It indicates membership of a set of some form.
It does.
So you're supplying an expression that you're turning around and saying, for this contract to be honored, then this expression must be true.
Yeah. Usually when you write an evaluation statement of some kind, it really does boil up to be a predicate. It's like a where statement in a SQL clause almost.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, really, that is.
By returning true, you indicate membership of the where set. Otherwise, it's false and it's excluded.
Yeah, that's right. So each contract uses a predicate as its definition. Mm-hmm. That can be executed by the compiler inside Visual Studio. Very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Very
powerful. Awesome.
In fact, I'm gonna pull up a project and we're going to take a look at it.
So it's number 23.
All right. Let's see. Perfect. So let's take a look at the kind of setup. So we have a class of animal and a cat that inherits animal. So we really like animals in our demos, no doubt about it. Yeah. So we have a single property, its name, and a single method of set name, very similar to what we had done before. So there's a lot of power here, right? So this is the demo we saw. In fact, wait a minute, let me make sure they all make sense together. Yeah, this is the demo we saw before. I don't know if it's 23. It does say 23, though, doesn't it?
It does say 23.
That's all right. I'll put it together. So these do the simple non-static validations, but I want to take all of these out, and I want to add instead data contracts to it as well, which beautifully are in dog, if I had only scrolled down a little bit more.
Indeed.
Dog
and cat.
Someone's
likely prepared this.
Dog and cat, yes. Golly, I'm so not disappointed in myself now. All right, so dog does the same thing, by the way, right? See, you can see that simple set name, and I set it with the validation. And now I have set name as well, but look at the power of it. It's really neat. Set name creates a contract that says dot requires. And dot requires are those preconditions that talk about the values being passed in. And so dot requires says that not the predicate is, not string is null or white space. That's me saying that the value being passed in can't be null, can't be white space. And if it is, there's a little message that I can pass to the user. Just to say, this is like a message being passed to the user.
Exactly.
Yeah, something really great. And all right, so that's the first one. This is great because it truly does replace all of the pieces in that we did above, right? It can do, all of these predicates can be replaced with a contract. Now, what's nice is their contracts also enable me to write in this longer syntax if I want to. I don't have to use contracts. I can do this and I can define a contract block and still use the same code and it can still execute at static time, which is really nice. Now, this is what I've accomplished in set. So I do all of the preconditions using requires, and I could add again and again all the ones that I need, like so. Right, and I could change those predicates to check whatever it is that I want. Now here's where it's cool. Here is getName. GetName is a method that returns something. I can use contracts here just like I did before, but I'll use them in post conditions. Here I'll use ensures to make sure that I can do it. And contracts have a neat method in their namespace here that says contract.result, which is a reference to what will eventually be returned by this method, and allows me to set up the contract here even if it's going to execute at runtime later. And so I can set, so here's the predicate, same exact thing. I cannot return an empty string, right? So I can't set name to empty string, neither can I return it to empty string. And just like before, I could create several different post conditions, all depending on whatever. And what's special about it is not just that it works, which is cool, but also that it works while I'm interacting with it as a developer at static time. Now, just a reminder, two quick caveats that developers need to know is that contracts only run statically if I am in, this is what we need to install.
Yeah.
If I have the add-on installed, and so the extension installed, and so if I do have that installed, then it changes what Visual Studio does so that it'll work statically at design time.
Adds a UI as well to enable you to interact with it.
It adds a UI to the project, thank you, into the project properties that allows me to configure it and also to kind of turn them up and down as far as volume, depending on how I want them to respond. They could cause build errors if I want to. And probably the most important thing to take away from contracts is, as much as these really do replace most approaches so that they can be a single approach to data validation, they can be overridden. And so let's say one of the tests is going to be a security test. A security test will then result in a contract violation. And so the it will be raised and you can handle it from there. However, I can actually handle that event so that the contract violation is ignored. And so you shouldn't, this is better of a best practice than anything, you shouldn't use contracts for security checking. Mm-hmm. But everything else, it just makes sense. It's a common language to use this way. It works at runtime and at compile time. It's very powerful, I love it. So back to this, it's not the wrong way to do it by using the standard approaches. At all is it the wrong way to do it. In fact, I can say right below it, contract.endContractBlock, and from that point forward, everything above that statement actually rolls all that to be contracts and treats it like contracts, and so their failures become contract exceptions.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's very powerful, and it gives me the static capability as well at design time. So there's certainly nothing wrong with this. Why would you choose contracts is because this sort of use of predicates is a unified way of handling both input and output. Mm. A lot of power there.
A lot of power. It's awesome.
Yeah, thanks.
There's that word again.
Is it awesome?
I believe so.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Seems to be my word of choice.
Seems very awesome.
It's better than bloviate, I guess.
Yeah. Better awesome than not.
Indeed.
All right. Here we are.
Okay.
So that's data contracts.
That's data contracts, and that's a good form of validation. So if you flick to my slides.
Flick.
So we have spoken an awful lot about exceptions, so we should perhaps talk a little bit about how do we handle them elegantly within our code itself, rather than just throwing them out into the ether. Because fundamentally, the runtime will ultimately handle any exceptions that we don't handle ourselves, but they'll do so by terminating our process with extreme prejudice, basically.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's fine. You know, it's a strategy if that's how you wish to deal with exceptions, is just leave it for the runtime. But unfortunately, you get a big fat dialogue that pops up and scares the heck out of your users. So I really wouldn't recommend that.
And can result in your application no longer being stable. Mm-hmm. Even if your app can, you know, they click continue and it still tries to run.
It's in an unknown state, effectively.
Yeah. And I think you made a good point, though, that the runtime will actually catch the exception. Mm-hmm. I mean, we say unhandled, but it's not endlessly unhandled. What we really mean is it bubbles all the way to the runtime and you expect it to do it, right? It will, but it's not happiness.
And in a lot of the development frameworks that you use, such as WPF, Silverlight, if you're using that, and so on and so forth, is at the main app layer, there is generally an event that gets raised which represents any unhandled exceptions that have occurred in your application. Mm. So you can actually trap them at that top level. And that is a strategy if you want to turn around and say, oops, something bad has happened. Unfortunately, we're going to have to shut down. And that's the strategy that you put in place.
Yeah, so let's talk about catching exceptions.
Yes. Right?
That's what we want to do. We want to catch them.
Exactly. And so imagine the scenario where we have this process, if you're looking at the code on the right-hand side. Mm. This process could throw exceptions. Mm-hmm. If we wish to be...
Oh, you mean the process?
You see? Yeah. It's English, American, bruised, not. There is this process method, and it could potentially throw exceptions, which would disrupt the execution of our application and potentially leave it in an unknown state. So mm-hmm. we wish to handle those. So the syntax in which we can say that we wish to handle this scenario is to leverage the try followed by a code block.
And try is nice, it's readable, and it really, what it means is try this out, and if it breaks, then, and there's stuff that comes
exactly.
later.
Exactly. Now, if we follow this on, we can see that it's followed by a catch statement. Now, there are a number of different ways that we could actually use catch. We could use catch without any parentheses or anything that follows it, and that would just be a standard bucket that would catch any exception and then execute the block that followed.
Yeah.
Now, what you just said is
it would catch any exception. That's very similar to the third block, where it's catching exception, which is the base of all exceptions.
Correct. Yeah. There is actually one type of exception that doesn't inherit from those, and that is a COM-based exception.
Ah, yeah.
And so catch would actually catch that. Mm. It's funny how we call these words things that are actually useful. Catch, catch, catch.
Yeah, it's nice.
Okay, but we can also chain together catches, and the advantage of chaining together catches is if we move from most specific to least specific, we can catch a number of different types of exceptions and deal with them in a different way. For example, here we have a divide by zero exception.
Yeah.
So if we want to be able to give a different action, or say, for example, whenever we get a divide by zero, we just want to return a value of zero, then we can intercept that exception and set the return value of this code block to return zero.
Divide by zero is a great example of raising an exception that really communicates what went wrong.
Exactly.
A generic one, it's still the same.
Yeah.
But the only reason you would use a typed is because you want to really be able to communicate what went wrong.
And it gives you the flexibility to respond to them in a different way.
That's right, because now you can have a catch for each type and you can respond to what exactly went wrong maybe differently. So you could potentially get something like file is closed or file is opened by another process.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could in your catch wait or perhaps look to see what's using it and let it release it, something like that.
And so this really speaks to the design process, the technical design process of implementing a solution, that you want to consider some of these scenarios and think, okay, if I am the developer of the process method that we're invoking at this point, what support and infrastructure do I want to provide to somebody who consumes this method?
Yeah.
And then one of the good uses for XML comments is to list out all of the exceptions that this method could throw, thereby inviting a consumer of this method to actually catch any ones that are useful, and then to use a bucket to catch all the remaining. So that's actually pretty cool.
That's, by the way, I want to jump on that because it's actually important. If you have a method and you have done a good job of documenting all the possible exceptions that can be raised, then I can actually test for those conditions. I can create a unit test or some sort of test mm-hmm. that says, I'm going to lock that file, and then I'm going to call your method, and I better get that file locked exception, right? And then I can test to make sure not only that it does what it's supposed to, but it does everything it's supposed to when the conditions are wrong. So there's a lot of power there, too.
Exactly. And for anybody who's involved in estimation for software development. These are the cases that you have to consider that normally screw up your estimates. That we typically estimate how long we think it's going to create to build the golden path. Mm. We don't necessarily consider all of the if scenarios that we need to deal with in that environment. And often that adds a significant amount of development time onto the process of actually solving the problem, is dealing with the real world data validation, exception handling, and so on and so forth.
It so goes back to the reality that the worst part of software development is users.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It works on my machine, TM.
TM. Yeah, too late for that one, man.
Shampoo. Okay, the other aspect of the try block is it can also optionally be followed by a finally statement.
Yeah, this is important.
Now, this is very important. We can actually use try and finally without having catch at all. What finally is a promise. Hmm. And that is, regardless of what occurs during the try block, the code that's contained in the finally block will always execute.
There is no exception to that.
There is no exception.
I think that's important. Finally is reliable.
It is.
Because you may be doing something in that try, let's say process. You're doing something in that process that's very expensive. It opens up files, it opens up resources, it holds open streams, whatever it does, and there's going to be a failure. Mm-hmm. And you could handle it well enough in the catch, but then you need to do something in the finally to release all of that stuff.
Exactly. And now a trick to bear in mind whenever you're dealing with the finally is make sure you cater for scenarios where everything's worked correctly and it's also gone horribly wrong. So say, for example, you open multiple files. The first file may open successfully. However, the second file may fail and throw an exception. If you assume in the finally block that you've got all your files open and you need to close all of those files, you could actually end up in an error state. So you need to perform checks in finally to make sure that you deal with any partially completed try activity.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It's funny, man. I mean, we do data validation to make sure that the user or whoever isn't giving us bad data. Then we use try catches to make sure all the stuff we're calling doesn't fail and do stuff we don't expect. We got some serious trust issues, only to move in now to encryption.
Yeah.
I mean, holy smokes, this module is all about...
How long
about
have you been coding? We've all got scars from all poor assumptions.
That's right. Exactly. You probably do. Okay, so let's talk about encryption. Well, we already did data validation, Tim. I don't think I can do much more there.
I think we're good.
And definitely it's around, with the takeaway, it's around contracts, right? Doesn't matter what framework you're using, there is a version of contracts for you.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so let's look at encryption.
Encryption.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is encryption?
I wanted to get it started. So, but the reality is encryption is taking data and making it not readable.
Correct.
Yeah.
Don't confuse encryption with security, although there is an aspect of security in terms of security by obscurity. You know, if you can't read it, then the data contained therein could be considered to be secure. Mm-hmm. But encryption isn't fundamentally about security. It is about making data unreadable.
Right. It can certainly increase security, but does not establish it.
Exactly. And, you know, when we're contrasting security there, we're talking about the ability to access something, whether you're authorized to access something. Encryption just makes it difficult to read once you get access to it.
Now, once you make it, let's just say impossible to read for fun. Nothing is impossible. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, whatever it is we're going to talk about can be undone. Just like anything that all levels of security can be unwound with enough effort. But encryption makes something unreadable.
Mm-hmm.
But we can read it.
We can read it because obviously with encryption there is the ability to decrypt it.
Decryption. All right.
Okay. And so we've talked about how rich the platform is in terms of the capabilities it provides. There are four foundational types of encryption that we can support within the .NET framework. And the great advantage of these encryption capabilities is they are implemented at the operating system level. They're part of the core of the system, and we're leveraging those within the managed environment. Okay.
And these are natively part of the framework waiting for you to use.
Exactly. They're baked in there and so on. And so they're going to operate as fast as your system can operate in terms of implementing encryption.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as we look at these in terms of the order from file encryption down to symmetric and asymmetric encryption, there are increasing levels of processor capability needed to perform those operations, both encryption and unencryption.
So encryption is expensive from a processor point of view, and the more intense the encryption, the more expensive. Don't pretend like it's free and it's going to happen like that.
Exactly. It's, you know, with everything comes a price.
Right.
So, as I say, we have file encryption, which is the simplest and is really based around you, the user. Mm. We then move on to Windows Data Protection, which, as it kind of implies, is baked into the Windows operating system. We have hashing, which we'll touch on, is basically used for signing and validating data. And then symmetric and asymmetric encryption, which is really about sharing beyond your user space.
Yeah.
So, if we look at file encryption, as the name suggests, it encrypts and decrypts files.
On a file level. And it doesn't have to, it doesn't mean a file that's inside your application. This is just a file that's on...
It's interacting with your Windows file system
yeah.
to actually encrypt them within the, a file system.
Yeah.
It's very fast because it's a native part of the system and it's effectively going to encrypt it on the disk. You may have seen encrypted files. They're highlighted green by default in Windows Explorer. And it's basically setting a bit flag on there indicating that this is compiled.
Let me encrypt something, can
sure,
I?
Sure, why not? Go ahead.
I'll show you something. I'll just encrypt it. So here's my, here are all of our slides for today.
Go for right? it.
Now that here's
do an earlier one, not a later
module.
One.
Well, yeah, I don't want to blow it. Yeah, exactly. So I'll go to its properties. And this is neat because this is one of the reasons it's so fast. It really is built in. This is yep. just you reaching out and switching this bit. And so I can look at the advanced properties of this class and I can see, from here I could compress it, which of course is not encryption at all, but I could just encrypt it right here. Now, when it does encrypt, it's encrypting for me, right? Mm-hmm. Is it making it unreadable for everybody, or is it anybody on my system?
You could choose.
Nah.
You could choose your scope. So basically, it's based on your user credentials, but you can really depend on where it's going to be.
Right. And so I'll go ahead and encrypt it. I'll say OK, or only this file. It goes. A couple seconds spin. Several seconds spin. It spins for a couple seconds. There's some spinning going on, and all of a sudden, like you said, the file is green, and that green is just a visual indicator for me to realize that this is an encrypted file. And so that's nice. Somebody else comes onto this machine, they navigate to my folders, they go in, they can look at all my slide decks until they get to module one, and module one is encrypted for my user. Very powerful, and this is what we get to do inside .NET. All right, that's file encryption.
Okay.
Simple.
If you want to flip back to me and look at my desk. So this is how you would actually implement file-based encryption within the source. So what I have here, and this is a project I'll be reusing for each of the major encryption types, here is the data that I wish to protect. So effectively, I have a string, and as I say, it's a bunch of super secret content that we wish to encrypt. Typically, we're going to
deal... Would you use encryption for just regular secret content? Does it... Super is important.
Super is definitely...
Level of encryption you
important.
Need.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, got it.
So, we typically deal with arrays, byte arrays, when we're actually dealing with encryption. And so, what we're doing here is, this is a method within the encoding class that will take a string, and we're applying Unicode encoding, which converts each character into 16 bits, that can be expressed in the Unicode character set. This gets those bytes and converts it into a byte array. And so we're going to use this throughout our situation, our scenario.
And the reason we're using byte arrays is because ultimately we're bringing everything back to number, numerics that we can interact with, right?
Exactly. We're dealing with those. And so now I've got a region. So this is a little piece of syntax that allows us to create collapsible regions in our editor. And so I can use this to break up my demo. What we're now doing is I'm just creating a file name
okay.
to access a particular...
Nothing to do with encryption here.
Nothing,
just where's the file go? You're
going
to put it in my documents folder.
And so we have the ability to turn around and say, get the folder, and we've got a special folder, document enumeration, and we create that together.
Nice.
Now I'm using a static method mm-hmm. on the file class to write out to a file name the data to protect. So this is going to contain this on the file system.
One of those methods, again, nothing to do with encryption, just an easy way to write text to a file.
Exactly. Now we get to the one part that is for encryption.
Now this has something to do with encryption?
It does.
Okay.
Do you know how you can tell that? It says encrypt in it. It's awesome.
I was reading the comment, actually.
Oh, I see. So basically, this is all we need to do to encrypt this file and protect it on our disk. The advantage of this is that if you lose your system, and somebody attacks your hard drive, takes your hard drive out and places it into another system, without your user credentials logged on, Windows will not be able to access the contents of this file, and so it is secure. So it's a great way for securing personal information on a system.
Best part is this is, without a doubt, the easiest implementation of encryption for .NET developers.
Absolutely. So now let's flip back. So the next level of encryption that is available to us is Windows Data Protection. Now again, as its name suggests, it's leveraging capabilities of the Windows operating system. So that kind of implies that there's going to be scope based around your environment and you. Mm. It's again very fast to encrypt and decrypt, and it's based upon your user credentials in the same way that file encryption is, i.e. it creates internally a key that can be used to encrypt and decrypt based upon who you are. Yeah. So if I flick back to the session, so if I open up the Windows Data Protection, should have done this yesterday.
Yeah, you should have.
Indeed. So we're again still interacting with the data to protect that we created up here, data to protect as an array, and we're basically saying protected data, dot protect.
And protected data is the namespace where we're finding it. Okay.
This is actually the static class, and this is the static method on protected data that will take this, compile it, or encrypt it rather. What the heck?
I changed your keyboard for lunch.
Good job. Good job. So this is an optional byte array that we can use that will vary the level of encryption by putting in additional random sets of bytes here. You can offset how the encryption is placed, and it includes an extra level of protection should you so wish. It's quite common to just pass null in this scenario.
Yeah.
And we also have the ability to say scope. So if we say data protection scope, current user, then obviously what that's implying is you have to be logged on as my user account in anything that I encrypt in this method so that I can then decrypt it.
This is exciting. Because I'm passing in current user, I think I might be able to pass in other things.
And here we go. We can see that we can also pass in a scope of local machine.
Anybody who logs on to this machine can decrypt this data that way.
Yeah, so if we think about a family scenario, you could encrypt data that you wish you, perhaps it's financial data that you and your wife wish to share. We can encrypt that and store that on the local machine. We can both access it by logging onto our machine, but if we lose it, then we don't lose our social security numbers when somebody else steals the hard drive.
Yeah.
So that's pretty slick.
Brilliant. And so I'm looking at Windows data protection and I'm looking at file protection and I'm seeing that they're sort of the same. One is encrypting something that's in memory, and one is encrypting a file on the system.
Well, you hit exactly the difference. So the file encryption uses Windows Data Protection services behind the scenes, but it gives you a shortcut mechanism to protecting files on your disk.
Brilliant.
This allows you to protect data in memory that you may then choose to write to a web service somewhere. You may choose to write it to a database directly and so on and so forth. So the data could be stored off your machine, but it is protected and only able to be unprotected, using the vernacular of this particular code,
right,
within the scope of this machine. Anybody else downloads it from that database on another machine, it's just gobbledygook to them. They can't touch it.
So this is encryption, taking the data so I can't read it. I get that. That's really, I mean, it makes sense. We're going to interact with a lot of data throughout the applications that we're going to write. Sometimes you're going to hit data that you should, honestly, just to be a good citizen, it should be encrypted. Too many things are probably stored as plain text. Now there's another step. Sometimes, because encryption is expensive, what you don't want to do is encrypt the entire payload. Instead, you want to start giving assurances around it that people aren't going in and monkeying with it.
Sounds like you want to sign it.
What I would like to do is sign, almost like, yeah, exactly, like a wax seal on an envelope that proves it hasn't been opened since the last time that whoever signed it. That's a good point.
It just so happens.
Is there some way to do that?
It's amazing.
Nice.
So, we have the ability to create hashes, and a hash effectively is a value that is derived from the contents of something, and that value is guaranteed to always be generated in an identical manner for the same content. And so we can use that to determine whether some data has been tampered with. It's a one-way encryption algorithm, which makes it really fast, because if you just code something together that loses a bunch of information but effectively is unique, you cannot recover the information from it if it's already lost a bunch of data. And so we can take, for example, the MD5 hash creates a 16-character hash. Regardless of how big the data is, the hash that comes out is only 16 characters long. There is no way you can reconstruct the original data from that hash because there's just not enough information there.
I think there's two key things around hashes that developers should lock in their brain. The first one is a hash can't be reverse engineered to recreate the string. Mm-hmm. But using like brute force, I could figure out the algorithm back down. I could try to cause it, right? And mm-hmm. I could finally get to it. So you can't go backwards, even though you might be able to do brute force against it. But I think the other one is it's also not unique. I could have the Gettysburg Address, get the hash of it, and let's say the resulting value is 123. I could also get the Declaration of Independence, and I could get the hash of that. It could be 123 again. They aren't guaranteed to be unique. They're guaranteed to be always the same based on the content that you pass into it.
You always arrive at the same value. Now, obviously, the larger the hash key that you use,
yeah.
the less likely there is to be collisions. You know, if you've only got 16 characters, then the likelihood for collisions increases dramatically.
Yeah.
The SHA algorithm allows you to have a number of different encryption types. The 256 seems to be the one that's used most commonly. That's a pretty long character string, and the likelihood of collisions there is pretty remote.
Mm-hmm.
One little aside is the SHA-512 and the SHA-384 take about the same amount of time to execute. So if you need greater strength than the 256 algorithm, you might as well just go straight to the SHA-512,
yeah.
which is interesting.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
I can tell you 512 digits of pi.
Well, good.
Come
back when you have done it.
We'll do that later.
Yeah, sounds good. So, typical use case for hashing is when you're storing passwords or you're comparing files, and also, as Jerry alluded to before, tamper checking. That in effect, rather than storing a password unencrypted in a database, you would hash it.
Mm-hmm.
You could store the hash. Because there is this guarantee that the same information will generate the same hash, instead, you compare the password hashes, and if they match, then you're logged on.
Yeah.
Now, if you're going to do that, you don't want to use the MD5 16-character hash because of the likelihood of collisions of repetition. You could randomly get a different password generating the same hash, which would then be a false positive. I mean, obviously, we don't want to do that.
Right.
So you want to move to the more secure versions of the hash.
Yeah, I would. I mean, obviously, you're going to combine username, email, all these other pieces as well. But certainly, having the risk of having the same hash result is definitely a danger. I guess a danger is the right word to use for it. Yeah.
So let's have a quick look at.
Well, let me back up just one more time. Another reason you might store a hash is because it's small. Even when we're talking about a long string, a hash for an entire book can be 512 characters, and I can still be checking against the entire book. There's another value of not storing the data and storing it only as a hash, I think.
Okay. So the code that I've got up on the screen right now illustrates how we would use a hash. So what I have here is this is a pre-generated hash that has been created based on this string. So I put that in already. You know, I ran the code earlier.
That's what happens when you run it, huh? Looks
exactly.
Like that.
That's cool. The output. That's the byte array. What we're doing a scenario here is we're turning around and saying, assume that this is a password hash that's stored out already.
Mm-hmm.
What we're then going to do is we're going to take a password.
You'd store it in Access, Microsoft Access.
Yeah, whichever database. Actually, I hashed this. I didn't hash the one above. So this is my password that I hashed that generated this byte array.
Yeah.
Then what I did is I used the SHA-256 algorithm to create. So this creates an instance of this algorithm.
Yeah.
And then I called the compute hash method on this algorithm instance, and I passed it in the password, which generates this byte array for the hash.
Yeah.
What I am now doing is comparing this array to this array. If they are identical, then because we're using the SHA-256 algorithm, we can be almost absolutely certain that this is the same password that's been entered in.
Very cool use of sequence equal.
Yeah.
Very cool.
This is a extension method that we've been able to pull in because this implements, because it's a password hash, it implements enumerable. and therefore sequence equal applies to that.
If I did use hash on a document, not a password, and somebody were to change a comma to a period, the hash would be different, and I'd be able to detect it. Also, I could compare hashes to see if passwords. This is brilliant.
It's incredibly powerful.
And appealing because it's not as processor intensive as full encryption.
It's full encryption, yeah. Yeah, it really is very useful when perhaps the body itself is not secret, but you wish to ensure consistency, that you wish to be able to verify. This is what was originally sent to me.
Yeah, and it is, you said earlier, signing. This is what it is. When you sign a document digitally, what happens is it creates a hash, and from that point forward, what you sign is associated to a hash that's combined with your identity.
Perfect. But now we're starting to get into the real meat and potatoes of encryption.
Good, just in time.
Just in time. We're starting to get to symmetric encryption. So you've got two main types of encryption that we really talk about once we get beyond hashing, symmetric and asymmetric. And the foundational difference between them is, with symmetric encryption, you use one key to both encrypt and decrypt content.
Yeah.
With asymmetric, there are two keys that are involved, and we'll get to that in a little bit more.
So the classic World War II scenario where you know the secret password,
yes,
that's symmetric. They couldn't have
it. Could be.
There is no asymmetric. Well, I mean, there is. It's elaborate. Never mind.
Exactly. Thanks very much for playing. Goodbye. The key thing, why would you use symmetric over asymmetric? Fundamentally, it's a lot faster. You're not having to do a whole bunch of complex algorithmic work to ensure that the product of the public key encryption can only be decrypted by the private key that you use in asymmetric.
Yeah.
So this same key works in both ways. There are five algorithms baked into the .NET framework, and really this talks about how algorithms come in and out of fashion over time. Many of the others are included in the namespace for backward compatibility for programs that were written previous generations of the .NET framework. Right now, the AES implementation is the recommended implementation to use. Both AES and Rheindahl, which is the funny spelling at second from bottom, is actually the same algorithm. AES has had some constraints placed upon it to enforce that you cannot use an insecure size of key.
Nice.
And so that's basically the fundamental difference between those. I'll flick onto asymmetric, and we'll cover both of those in a quick code view in a moment. So on the asymmetric side of the house, if we look at this slide, another name for it is public key encryption. And the key here is, overloading the term key, goodness, is you have one key that's used for encryption and another key that's used for decryption. So you can share the public key for encryption, so that things can be passed around, but the key for decryption should be kept private and guarded as one of your most secret of secrets.
So I'm going to send you a message. I'm going to take that payload. I have your public key. I can encrypt it. As soon as I've encrypted, even though I have your public key, I could never see it again. It is encrypted, and only your private key could ever decrypt it again. So it's a safe way for me to send you a message and to know that it doesn't matter if Frank gets it or anybody else, they're never going to open it because only you have your private key.
Exactly. And it's used for digital signatures to enforce that what I'm passing across has only come from you. It's a guaranteed source. And a common way of doing it is using certificates.
Yeah.
You can purchase these public signing certificates where you purchase a private public key pair.
And they're responsible for ensuring that identity really is you.
Exactly.
That's what that's about.
And so that's where your trust is established, that you have this external agency that calls you up and says, okay, what's your social security number? Who are you? Where are you?
Right.
Prove whom you are. And then they can issue you a personal one, or the same for corporate, that Microsoft has a public key cert that it leverages for its SSL. And you'll see on browsers, you get the padlock that indicates this is a secure certificate, it hasn't been
Works the
violated.
Same way.
It's exactly the same.
Same thing with application certificates to make sure the application that you're installing really really was published or built by the trusted brand, trusted name.
Exactly. And so if we look at the cryptography namespace for the asymmetric algorithm, there are four. All four of these are safe. They produce sufficiently encrypted information that you can trust them. However, the RSA algorithm seems to be the most popular, and that's the one we'll look at in a moment.
Great. Let's take a look at the code. I'd love to see how it's all implemented. I'm sure it's a million lines.
The nice thing is, it isn't.
Oh, good. Half a million.
So, this is the symmetric algorithm. As I mentioned, it uses Rheindahl. Rheindahl.
Mm-hmm. Of course it is.
Heck of a word. Just rolls off the tongue, huh?
It's Rheindahl. And that's my third child.
Oh, good. Oh, how unfortunate. Next to reindeer? Reindeer and Tinkerbell. Okay.
They're all sons, just so you know.
Exactly.
Kind of blew it for them.
Okay. So this is the key. And we can actually use different sizes of key, but I've chosen to use 16 bytes at this point.
Size definitely implies processor intensivity. how much work it works.
Yeah, it makes it damn hard work.
Requires. But certainly it also implies security.
Exactly. So your bigger the key, then the more heavily encrypted your code will be.
Yeah.
And the less likely brute force attacks will ever be able to decrypt it. But 16 bits, or 16 bytes rather, of key. I forget the exact figure of how much effort it is to actually crack into it, but this is secure.
Yeah.
It's considered to be secure.
If you were doing it with an abacus, it would take all day.
All day.
Yeah.
That's awesome. There is another part of the key, or part of the encryption vector that we can supply, which is an initialization vector. And what this is kind of, it's similar to seed within random. So if you've used the random class at all, you can use random and it will kind of leverage your current time as a base seed to generate random numbers. You can inject in a new seed that will change the offset from where it starts to generating random numbers. That's the same kind of principle with the initialization vector. And one of the nice things about the initialization vector is you can use a common key that you've shared, but you can also embed an initialization vector into each message that you send backwards and forwards to add another degree of randomness to the encryption, as long as you're sharing it backwards and forwards. Just don't duplicate that initialization vector across messages. Just keep changing that initialization vector, and it makes it even harder to break.
And an init vector really is more like an additional password.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. So anyway, in terms of using this is a pretty common pattern. So we create an instance of our algorithm. And I'm not using at this point because I want to save this for reuse for my decryption down below. Here we have three usings back to back, and this is actually a handy syntax for nesting using statements. We're not using a block inside each one of these, so it stops indenting it all the way across the page, which makes it harder to read.
Yeah, I like that.
So this is a nice shorthand for that. But basically what we've got is, we've got three levels of disposable object that we're actually using here, and we're actually implying a life cycle that this is dependent upon this, the cryptography is dependent upon memory, which is dependent upon encryption.
Yeah.
So as we roll out of this, those things will be disposed out in that order as well, which is kind of
cool. It's really neat. Yeah. It's really, really neat.
So we've got an algorithm, and effectively we call a method on this create an encryptor.
Got it.
And we pass in our key and our initialization vector. Often you will see people use the same key for both the key and the initialization vector. That's perfectly valid. It just defeats the purpose of the initialization vector.
Yeah.
What we're going to do is we're actually going to encrypt things in memory. And so I'm creating a memory stream, which is going to be where the encrypted data gets written to.
Very similar to Windows Data Protection that changed or was encrypting data that was in memory. This
exactly.
Does the same thing.
Exactly. Now, the difference between creating a byte array and using a memory stream is a memory stream will size itself based upon the content that's being written to it, whereas a byte array has finite bounds.
Yeah, you define it up front.
Exactly. So, and then finally we have a cryptography screen. And this stream accepts the memory stream as part of its constructor. It also accepts the encryptor that it will use to encrypt the content. And let's get hold of that. And it will also say, okay, this is the mode that it's going to write to this stream, because we can also read and pull in different directions. But for consistency's sake, we're always going to be writing.
Just a wrapper around the stream is what it ends up being.
Exactly. And that's very, very simple to use. We're basically writing to the crypto stream.
Yep.
The data we want to protect that's already encoded into
a byte. Or writing to the memory stream. Got it.
Well, we're writing through that the crypto stream, which writes to the memory stream by doing the encryption.
Okay.
And then this is just a simple offset where we want to start in this array. So we're starting at the beginning.
It's friendly.
And we're running all the way through the length of that array. So we could actually just encode a small part of it if we wished to, but obviously most scenarios you want to encode the whole lot.
Yeah, you'd have to really know what you're doing if you're going to just do one paragraph.
Exactly. Now, because we're dealing with a stream, the way streams are optimized to work is they generally write in chunks. And so if we haven't completely filled the chunk, then it won't have flushed the stream. So what we do is say flush the final block even if it's an incomplete chunk.
Sure.
And that's what we're doing there. Then I get hold of the memory stream, convert it to an array so that it takes that buffer of variable size and outputs it as an array and writes it into symmetric encrypted data, which is a byte array I declared.
It's a simple byte. And I could take that byte array then and write it to something. Put it in a database. I could put it into a file now.
Exactly.
And it beautiful. All right.
Yep.
So now I've got my byte array completely encrypted, and I super secret secrets are secret.
Exactly. And then to decrypt it, it's pretty much a very similar set. You know, it's pretty much the same pattern. The only difference is we're using our algorithm that we created up above here.
Right.
Instead of saying create encryptor, we create a decryptor. Mm. We're passing in the same key in the initialization vector. We're using a memory stream again. We're using cryptostream. We pass in the decryptor this time.
Yep.
We're still writing to our memory stream.
We are.
And then we basically say cryptostream write.
And it knows what to do because that's what you created, a decryptor, not
exactly.
An encryptor.
Exactly. And it takes our encrypted data and the length of it. We flush out the block again. And we write it back into the unencrypted data. And then down here, we do a sequence equal to compare those two, and we'll find that they're exactly the same contents, that we have successfully encrypted and decrypted it. So this is both sides of the conversation of using encryption.
And I think what some people don't realize is that in the decryption of text, it will actually correct your grammar. That's probably the only change between the two. It won't actually do that, of course. And now we have this is symmetric, and I think it's worth reminding. I meant to say this at the beginning of the module here that all of the code that we have and that we're showing is in a solution that's available to you. You can download it right now. It's at xaml.codeplex.com. You can look there at the Microsoft Virtual Academy link and download it and go through it as well. We just showed off symmetric decryption. Right below it is asymmetric decryption. As well. You can look at that and you can use that code in your own application. You just use it for your own learning as well.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take a look back. This module has been a very meaty module. I mean, it really has. I mean, we started with the validation of types and this idea that we can't really trust everything that comes to us. And we don't. We can't trust it and for the sake of the user, for the sake of the stability of our application. And we talked about design by contract and this contract namespace that allows us to not only interrogate things that come into our methods, but we can also do it out. And not only can we do it at runtime, but we can always also do it statically while we're developing. And then we talked about the special ways of handling exceptions and how exceptions are exceptional, and we raise them on purpose. But when they do, how do we keep them from wrecking our system? We do that with different try blocks, and then how try block can catch, but it also has that finally to ensure some sort of action that needs to be done when all of those operations are complete. And then we went through encryption and the complexity of encryption, and really how that complexity has been sort of winnowed down thanks to the framework exposing both file encryption, the native Windows protection, as well as you going all out with symmetric or asymmetric encryption.
Yeah, and obviously we didn't get to the asymmetric part, but you can see that embedded in that solution.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 10 minutes with Module 5. Enjoy.